Hi, Mark Lemon.
Hi, Megan.
How are you?
I'm well. I'm Mark Lemon, reality-based community in UCLA.
I'm Megan McArdle of the Atlantic Monthly, and today we're going to be blogging heads on a variety of exciting topics, starting with Sarah Palin. How about that, Sarah Palin, Mark?
Who's that? Never heard of her. Well, I mean, we did get a surprise, didn't we?
I would say that, yes.
And the McCain folks seem to be incredibly proud of themselves. They managed to do the whole thing without a leak. And that's true, certainly compared to the Biden pick. The markets had no idea about Palin. I mean, 24 hours in advance, you could have bought Palin on Intrade for about 4 cents.
Yeah, I was shocked. I was actually in New York doing an interview when the secretary of the guy I was interviewing knocked on the door and said, "It's Palin."
Right. So they maintained pretty good OPSEC. But nobody in the McCain camp seems to have noticed the downside, which is that if you leak the names for a week or 2 weeks, you get everybody in the country a chance to say, "Oh, no, not him." And instead, they not only scanted their internal vetting process, but they didn't allow any sort of external vetting process. So this is Kleinman's first law of karma yoga. You give surprises, you get surprises. And they're now
that.
Just learning. You're didn't teach that one? They're just now learning what they got. And I think a lot of people in the country are feeling sympathetic with Palin. I mean, she's a lot closer to being an ordinary person than almost anybody who's ever been in that position before.
Right. Well, Harry Truman, maybe.
Well, but Harry Truman had been in public office for 30 years. I mean, he was a career politician.
Right. Although she's been in now for, what, 16 years?
Well, she was a city councilor in a town of 6,000. Right, that's not a full-time job. I think mayor probably is a full-time job. So she was mayor for 6 years, and now she's been governor for a little less than two. But anyway, she sort of looks like an ordinary person in lots of ways.
Right.
And so there's a little bit of danger here for the Democrats that if they beat up on her too much, about how unfit she is for the job and so on. I think some voters can take that quite personally.
Oh, I think that, you know, you're Tyler Cowen has made this point, and I think he's absolutely right. Is that, you know, for the Democrats to beat up on this woman is for the Democrats to say, well, you know, you sitting there in your living room, you're not really adequate.
You're an idiot, and we
shouldn't let you make decisions, which then, of course, raises the question of why we're letting you vote at all. But
right. I actually think that lots of voters, sort of ordinary people, are going to say, and in fact, one of the sportscasters in Alaska said a couple days after the pick, well, you know, her only, you know, private sector experience is as a sportscaster. Maybe I should run for vice president. So a lot of people are going to say just the opposite, which is, well, hell, I'm not ready for that job. And she's just like me.
Do you think that's true? I suspect that almost everyone secretly cherishes the notion that if they could... If they were just given a chance, they could straighten things out.
Oh.
I mean, I think of how many, like, journalists I read criticizing, say, GM's management for running the company into the ground, as if, you know, running GM were only slightly more difficult than filing a column twice weekly.
Right.
And it probably doesn't take any particular talent at all, and,
right.
You know.
There's certainly some of that. But it seems to me that what that points to from the Democrats' point of view is that they ought to do what is the right thing to do, which is not criticize Palin for being who she is. She is who she is. And if the people of Alaska wanted her for governor, then they were entitled to have her. But to criticize McCain for making such an insanely reckless choice. You know, it's sort of a little bit like saying... Now, on one hand, you could say, who the hell does Incitatus think he is running for consul? He's just a horse. Compared to, who the hell does Caligula think he is running his horse for consul? So I think the more the focus stays on McCain and his decision process.
I don't know, though. I think you still run into the same problem, which is that you're saying to people, you know, the only qualification for high office in this country is to have been the product of this sort of machine. Which, I mean, like, first of all, I mean, I think there's a large element. Large might be the wrong word. There was a significant element of the Republican electoral base that really cherishes the notion that the Founding Fathers had of sort of citizen legislators, of people mm-hmm. who would come out of the private sector, do this for a couple of years, and then, you know, sort of go back. And I also think that...
note that the Founders never gave us an inexperienced president. Right, I mean, everybody who was president in that founding generation had been in public affairs most of his life.
Well, right, but if you think about the guys who started the revolution, right, they were all wildly inexperienced. They had no idea what they were doing. You know, you read something like John Adams or see the HBO special, and it's
right.
just, I mean, it's sort of shocking how little these guys, they were just sort of putzing around. And it's amazing that we had such great putzes.
Right.
But, you know, yes, they didn't elect people to high office that way, but the people who were in charge at the beginning were people who had no idea, largely, right. what to do about statecraft and all of this stuff. They were guys with a bunch of theories that, you know, some of which panned out and some of which didn't, and they shot in the dark and they got lucky because right. France was at war with England. I mean, you know, there was a huge amount of luck to all of this. So I think that's part of it, but I think that there's a broader problem, which is just that, I mean, I think that as a commentator, a really legitimate problem to have with Palin is that I think that she actually is electorally brilliant. She's an electorally brilliant choice, sort of day one of the presidency, not such a good choice.
Right.
I have not followed this as closely. I'm in the middle of sort of the end stages of writing a story about income inequality, which we may talk about later. Right. But so I haven't followed this nearly as closely as most sort of bloggers have. But the problem, right, is that when she is electorally brilliant for these reasons, she's a woman, she's sort of ordinary, she's made the choices that certainly at least a lot of the Republican electorate wishes they'd made. And she succeeded by being kind of an ordinary person who's stepped into the legislative process from not particularly fairly unprepossessing roots and so forth. And so I think it really is hard to attack her. It's hard to, you know, she's electorally brilliant because they like her, and any attack on him for her
mm-hmm.
is, I think, going to rebound against Obama. I mean, I can agree with you intellectually, but I think, you know, solely as a matter of politics, I think it's really, really difficult to go after her. And that's why the McCain camp chose her, is that she is, you know, sort of really, really difficult to attack, in part because, you know, Tyler Cowen also said this, less attractive men attacking an attractive woman.
Mm-hmm.
Arouses the maternal instinct in the electorate, especially if she stays cool and doesn't fire back. I mean, you know, like, Hillary Clinton has a sort of, like, commanding personality that Sarah Palin doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So it was possible to attack her because people perceived her, you know, not
right.
saying this is legitimate, but people perceived her as a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
When you attack someone who, like, basically strikes everyone as, like, a nice mom,
right.
they're going to treat you as if you walked up to the street you know, walk up to a nice mom on the street and started attacking her, and that's not fair.
Right.
I'm, you know, I'm not saying this is how it should be, but I think that is how it is.
It's also an inaccurate perception. Turns out she has wields a pretty nasty shit in politics with a smile. So when she was mayor, she fired the police chief for no reason other than she didn't like him. And he sued, and her defense in court was, well, look, I'm the mayor. I get to fire the police chief for any reason I want. It's employment at will. And the court said, yep, employment at will. And then she did the same thing with the state police chief, you know, in a somewhat nastier setting where she was getting revenge for a personal thing. I'm not sure that's going to go over well.
I don't know. I'm interested because most Republicans are for right to work. Most of them, you know, but certainly most of the base is for, yeah, your boss doesn't like you, can fire you. And that's the reality of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Boss doesn't like me, I'll get fired.
Mm-hmm.
Should the police chief be special? No.
Maybe.
And you know, so I think that like they may resent that, and you know, it could go either way, right? They could resent that fact of their life, but the fact is, a lot of people feel like, you know, a lot of the resentment about Democrats, I think, is that they feel like Democrats have set up special rules for government employees where, you know, I have to go to work and please my boss even if he's a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't please him, he'll fire me.
Right.
And that's life. And that, why would that not be true of the police chief?
Mm-hmm.
Why would that not be true of the head of HUD or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the way, you know, why are government employees some special elect group who doesn't have that happen to them? So I'm not sure. I mean, and political appointees get fired when they don't get, and certainly at the federal level, right? Political appointees get fired when they don't get along with the administration.
Right. Yeah, the question.
So I don't know.
Right. The fact that you're stonewalling the state investigation, I think, is not going to look good.
Those things are certainly going to have more traction than she's an idiot.
Right. Well, and the fact that the claim they rolled out for her, and that you know they put into the speech she made at her first appearance, that she killed the bridge to nowhere, right, turns out to be false. Right, so the truth of the matter is that she supported the bridge to nowhere. She said how important it was. She went to the town and said, look, this isn't nowhere to me. We've got to defend Alaska from the outsiders who think that we're unimportant. We've got to get this through as long while we've got the power in our congressional delegation to get it through. When she got to be governor and there was pressure in Congress and they took off the earmark for that particular project, she didn't fund it. But McCain's critique of the bridge to nowhere was, look, we could have been spending that money fixing the bridges across the Mississippi.
Right.
Well, it turns out that when Palin canceled the bridge to nowhere, she didn't give any of that money back to the Transportation Trust Fund. It simply went to other pork projects in Alaska. And, just to top it off, there was an access road being built to the bridge. And the access road was in fact an earmark, so that if she canceled that project, the money would have gone back to the General Treasury or to the Transportation Trust Fund and been available to fix the bridges in Minnesota. And so, even though she's not building the bridge to nowhere, she's still building the access road to the non-bridge to nowhere with your money.
Well, I would say a couple of things about that. I mean, I think, first of all, the bridge in Minnesota has now been shown to be a structural fault in the steel that no one would have detected.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a maintenance problem. So, you know, I don't think that...
Well, but that simply cuts against McCain's honesty, since that's the point he made about the bridge to nowhere.
Well, I would say a bunch of things about this. I mean, first of all, I'm 100% opposed to bridges to nowhere and earmarks, and I'm kind of skeptical about the Department of Transportation in general. Like a good libertarian. So I'm with you that she shouldn't support these things because I don't want my politicians to support them. I think that the dishonesty won't play well. I don't know how badly it's going to play, though, because all of these guys, like, you know, I'm pretty sure at this point that Obama's fudged his record on at least one policy position.
No, but it's different. But
I would be shocked if he and McCain had.
But it's different. It's different when you roll somebody out and say, "Look, here is this person's great accomplishment. She's a reformer who really got results. She killed the bridge to nowhere." And when you look at that claim and it turns out not to be true, that I think hurts a little more, and more important, raises the question about how much McCain knew. Right? When they made that claim, were McCain's handlers and McCain deliberately lying to the whole population? Or did they actually believe what they'd been told about that because they hadn't done an adequate vetting job?
But more broadly, you know, I think Biden's got a bunch of skeletons in his closet. And attacking the VP choice isn't necessarily, like, Biden brings some, you know, but fighting about which VP is more dishonest is not going to be a good line for the Obama campaign. You know, Joe Biden has told some, I mean, he plagiarized Neil Kinnock in an incredibly stupid way.
Megan, I'm a very big unfan of Joe Biden for lots of different reasons. But that was a bogus charge. And Mike Dukakis was right to fire Sasso for putting it around. The story on that was that Kinnock had this wonderfully effective speech
about being a coal mine, son of
right.
coal mine.
And you know, where all my ancestors been. And Biden on the campaign trail.
Fascinatingly, I'm told by someone else that Kinnock himself actually plagiarized part of that speech. But
entirely possible. I mean, look, it's not as if these tropes are privately owned. Anyway, Kinnock had a very effective speech, which Biden had heard about and picked up and quoted on the campaign trail. He said...
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. He quoted it once... with
he
attribution, and then continued to use it in other... This is my understanding of what actually happened, is that he did quote it and attribute it once. But then he continued to use it in a speech without making it clear that it was a quote, in other contexts. So yes, he did attribute it once, but in front of other audiences, he did not attribute the speech, and made it sound as if he were...
My understanding at the time, and I was a Dukakis fan, so this was not... plumping for my God. My understanding at the time, and I think the received wisdom on this was, it was part of his stump speech. He told the story dozens of times, mentioning Kinnock. Once, late at night, he was tired and left Kinnock's name out. And the Dukakis people got the video of that and put it around.
I think it was a couple more times than once. I mean, I think, like, I can understand how that
right.
sort of thing happens. Because these guys are exhausted. I mean, he's also told some fairly major bloomers, fairly major. My understanding of Joe Biden is that he's not always been entirely honest about his policy.
This is a long, long way from somebody who claims to be a reformer, claims to have defeated the Republican establishment in Alaska. Turns out she was one of the organizers of a 527 Independent Expenditure Committee for Ted Stevens. Right, these are the activities that John McCain says are flatly illegal under the law he wrote. Right?
Right.
She was...
Although, I mean, like, John McCain at this point has already violated his
well,
own
yes,
campaign
of course,
laws, right?
Of course, but...
So, you know, if that
right.
didn't stick,
But it turns out that this reformer not only was on a 527 for Stevens, not only had a video with Stevens as part of her last campaign, which video, of course, has now been taken down from her website, but I guess they never heard of YouTube because it's all over the place. But not only that, when she was the mayor of this little town of 6,000, it was one of only six towns in Alaska that had its own federal lobbyist who did indeed bring in $27 million of pork from the federal government for this town of 6,000. The lobbyist...
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you.
No,
this is
worse.
Not...
The lobbyist was the former chief of staff for Ted Stevens. And was an accomplice of Jack Abramoff. So she was as deep into the Republican Alaskan sludge as you can possibly get. All that happened was after she got elected, she sold out the people who put her there. Which, you know, I mean, I'm always delighted when thieves fall out. But for the McCain campaign to be presenting this woman to us as a reformer is really pretty outrageous. And again, raises the question about whether...
Well,
they,
you know,
whether they were dishonest or just didn't know.
I guess I just wonder, is this really inside baseball? You know, this is the stuff that you and I thrive on, but that's not the narrative that drives campaigns. Like, this kind of stuff where you have, like, how many people even know what a 527
yeah.
is? Or for that matter, who Ted Stevens is? I mean, like, by the time you've gotten done explaining all of that,
no one cares. But the simple claim
and
is
so
that
I think
John
that
McCain presented his vice presidential candidate to us with a crashing lie. That's not hard to understand. And their best...
I think you have to then explain
right.
what the... I think it's too complicated, and I think that kind of stuff... That kind of, like, minor corruption taint, you know, it's going to be all over Joe Biden.
Yeah, but,
it's going to be all over anyone who's been in politics.
But her whole
for,
claim is, hey, I'm not one of those politicians. I'm just a housewife. Let me wipe the moose grease off my hands.
I'm not disagreeing with you that she is not, in fact, what the McCain... campaign is presenting her as. All I'm saying is that I just don't think that that's a successful narrative to take against. I mean, I think that the Obama campaign will do best.
Oh, the Obama campaign is not going to touch any of this. What other people say.
But, you know, even people who, again, because it goes back to, like, nice housewife mom, if you don't make the charge stick, you've hurt yourself. And it's very likely that you will not make the charge stick, because the public attention span is not there for this kind of incredibly fine-grained, you know, track 3, 527 groups, and then, you know, look at this.
Yeah, the charge that's sticking
so is... So I think that you're likely to backfire if you're trying to make
lack of any knowledge or opinion or experience that has anything to do with national security, where they've been making that the whole centerpiece of their campaign. And this attempt... And they keep saying she was the commander-in-chief of the Alaska National Guard. And I don't know whether you saw the CNN reporter destroy the McCain guy on that. But it turns out that the adjutant general of the Alaska National Guard gave an interview to AP and said, well, no. No, the governor's in charge of relief and rescue operations in Alaska. But any national security, any national defense thing that the Alaska National Guard does is run by the Pentagon. The governor isn't even briefed on the situation.
Right.
And that's something that voters can understand.
I would say this, though. You've got a problem, which is that every governor who runs has the same issue. They don't have any hands-on experience in national security.
Oh, yeah, no.
And if you're trying to harken back to the Bill Clinton legacy, you cannot simultaneously say, you know, we want a great 8 years like those under Bill Clinton, and also Sarah Palin being a governor isn't qualified.
Nobody's saying that the fact that she didn't actually run the Alaska National Guard means she's not qualified for the presidency. But the McCain campaign has been experience, 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 ready from day one. You've got a guy, 72 years old. He's had 4 recurrences of his cancer. If he were a 72-year-old in normal health, there'd be about 1 chance in 5 that he'd either be dead or badly disabled at the end of his first term. Add to that his own health history and the demands of the presidency, and you're looking at a pretty substantial probability that this one actually winds up in the Oval Office. And against that, no governor has real foreign policy experience. But lots of governors have traveled the world.
Well, and you've got Obama. I mean, I don't think Obama... I think this is actually going to make it harder for McCain to make the experience argument. But I don't think the Obama campaign certainly cannot fire back with it. Obama has... He's been in office less time than she has, and most of his time in office is as a state senator, which is about as, you know, qualified... It's probably less qualified to be president than someone who's had executive experience at the local level. Being a state senator is exactly nothing like being president of the United States. So, I agree with you. It's going to make it harder for McCain to make this argument, and I think that it will be effective if the Barack Obama campaign brings it up in response to a specific remark by McCain. I do not think that this is an effective strategy for the Obama campaign to go out against McCain with. And I don't think that, you know, talking about judgment, because it redounds back on Obama. He just doesn't have very much experience at the national level.
Right. But the difference is, if you go to ontheissues.org, right, it's a website that simply publishes all of the stated positions of candidates on things, and you look at the Sarah Palin page, at least as of 2 days ago, there was nothing. She had a couple of specific issues on specific Alaska issues. But here's somebody who was asked a couple of months ago what she thought about the surge, and said, well, I haven't... You know, I've been running Alaska. I haven't really looked at Iraq. I hope they have a plan. That's very different from the question of how much decision-making experience she's had. As far as you can tell, she's got no opinions on these
things. Yeah, though, I think that, you know, like James Fallows pointed this out on his blog for The Atlantic recently. None of these guys have enough experience to know about all the issues they're expected to have opinions on.
No, but...
None of them do. And that's why they make major... That's why, as he said, Obama made a fairly major gaffe at AIPAC last year, because they're, you know, as Fallows said, look, the difference between referring to Taiwan and China and Taiwan and mainland China in terms of China-Taiwan relationship is huge. Sorry, my phone is going, but so that difference is enormous, but. There's so many of those issues. The issues, you know, fine-grained stuff about Hamas, about versus Fatah, and any, you know, there are a number of regions that are hugely important regions that they really need to have, like, a strong opinion on. And none of them could possibly have had a strong opinion on them until they started running for office and started developing them.
Well, but that's the whole point. That's the whole point. That the fact that Obama's been running for president for 18 months now has given him a chance to learn about foreign affairs and also to learn about the country. I mean, I think it's the case, I'm not sure it's the case, that Sarah Palin's first visit to Ohio was flying to Dayton for that introduction. I mean, it's not just that she doesn't know the rest of the world. She doesn't know the United States.
You know, it's kind of like you're talking about an electorate that liked George Bush because he kind of, like, George Bush, if you look at him from, like, his speeches in Texas, he acts visibly dumber now than he did in Texas.
Right.
And it's not that he got stupider. It's that this is electorally successful for him.
Right. No, I
so, you know, I just, I like, again, I'm not disagreeing with you sort of on the substance, but on the electoral strategy, I think the best electoral strategy is just leave her alone. Don't talk about it. Like, you know, let her do the debate with Biden, see how she does. Hopefully for the Democrats, Biden will crush her. But I just don't think that there is any successful way to attack this woman without being more likely to damage Obama than to damage the McCain campaign.
So far, it looks as if McCain is getting an anti-bounce out of Palin.
I don't know how you would know that because you know you got the Democrats just had their campaign, and the campaign bounce usually hits after the nominee gives a speech.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you could say it's an anti-bounce. It would be normal to see Obama going up in the polls right now.
Right. Well, maybe that's right.
And in fact, you know, he's gone up in the polls shockingly little compared to a normal campaign bounce. So if anything, I would argue that probably the Palin pick was smart enough to temper some of. I mean, I actually, you know, and I said this. I was disappointed in the Obama speech, not because I didn't think it was a bad speech. There were some of the things that he said, which are just sort of demonstrably false lies that I'm sure McCain will tell the same stupid lies in his speech about things like we're going to end our dependence on foreign oil.
Right.
No, we're not. This is a lie. It's not even like, you couldn't even vaguely believe that and have an IQ and have been in government for more than 3 seconds. So
my colleague at the Kennedy School, Bill Hogan, was on Richard Nixon's Energy Independence Task Force, which was charged with making the United States energy independent within 10 years. And Bill tells
a story
about...
Sorry, Mark, do you speak up a little bit?
Sorry. And Bill tells a story about that, the first meeting of that group. And so the first thing the group did in addressing the presidential charge to make the country energy independent within 10 years was to redefine energy independence. And the next thing they did was redefine 10 years.
Yes, exactly. And everyone, like, I'm not singling out Obama because I think this is, like, not mandatory. Like, as soon as you file for presidency, they make you sign a form promising that you were going to promise to make the country energy independent within 10 years.
Right.
But so, like, aside from those kinds of things that just sort of generally enraged me, and I'll pick on in McCain's speech as well, it was a fine speech, but I feel like I was expecting, like, he's given so many good speeches.
It was fine.
It was a standard good Obama speech, but he's given way better speeches than that. And so I think that in a way, like, he's set up really high expectations.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the opposite is true for Palin tonight.
Yeah. But that were hard to surpass, and he didn't surpass them, and that because he didn't surpass them, he didn't get the kind of balance that, like, that normal, you know, politicians do. We expected him to be like, you know, Martin Luther King, and he didn't get to that level.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I'm looking at the polls right now, and I'm pretty happy.
McCain's going to get his bounce at the end of this week. You have to remember that, like, it tends to go back sort of to roughly where it was with a few percentage points.
But I doubt it. I think this is a different week. First off, I don't know how many people are watching. I've not seen the data.
No one watches it. It's amazing. Like, every 4 years they do this story about how the ratings are declining. And it's like, how much longer? They fall by half. Like, it's like they,
right.
you know, the
except,
ratings on these things have, like, a half-life. Pretty soon it's just going to be you and me watching the convention more.
No, but Kerry's acceptance speech had 22 million viewers. Obama's acceptance speech had 38 million viewers. Right? So that pattern was shattered. And that's not even counting the fact that lots of people, I mean, I'm not a viewer because I don't own a television set. I've only watched the damn thing three times, right?
So it'll be just me.
but I'm saying that's not counting, the 38 million is not counting all the people who saw it on the tube. I mean, on the internet.
Right.
Right, it's only people who watched network or cable that night. So no, I mean, the pattern you quoted is the correct pattern historically. Completely shattered on the Democratic side this year.
But then why didn't he bounce more? His bounce was tiny.
I guess
I feel like is the people who were supporting him and who everyone turned in to watch because his supporters are so ardent.
But he clearly managed to shore up his support among Democrats. He's now running as well among Democrats as McCain is among Republicans. So basically, the convention did the thing it was supposed to do, which is bring the Clintonites home. That's all it needed to do.
I don't know. I feel like McCain running as well as McCain among Republicans is like that's not playing against the varsity.
Oh no! McCain's doing as well.
They don't like him. Half the base hates him, and everyone's disgusted by George Bush.
But McCain is doing as well among Republicans as George Bush did. He's in the 80s, which is fine. As somebody pointed out, because of the changes in party ID, if Democrats, Republicans, and Independents split in the same proportions this year that they split 3 years ago.
Sorry about that. A little technical interruption on my side. Anyway, we should probably move on because we've got a host of really interesting topics about which Mark has a host of interesting things to say. So maybe now's a good time to move on to talking about risk-taking and John McCain and this risky VP choice.
Right. I was struck at David Brooks's column yesterday, where he talks about Palin as evidence of McCain's sensation-seeking personality. That's of course a concept I'm familiar with professionally, because it's a very good explanation for things like drug abuse and juvenile delinquency among adolescents. As a recommendation for a president from a friendly reporter, it struck me as a little bit underwhelming.
Yeah, I'm definitely not a McCain supporter. And I
didn't
think
know
that actually adolescent is the right way to sort of characterize his personality.
No,
as kind of
right.
like a perpetual, you know, what he did to his first wife. People have been talking today, and I said that I was sort of disgusted by all the discussion of Bristol Palin's pregnancy among sort of like the not entirely fringe, but you know, some of the more worked up Obama supporters, that, you know, I should also mention that John McCain had said nasty things about Chelsea Clinton, and he didn't. It was just juvenile. You're like, this is like a 55, 60-year-old man who is behaving as if he's a frat brother. Think that...
The most appalling thing about that story, which hasn't come out very much, so he said this grossly appalling thing about Chelsea Clinton that involved both an insult to Hillary Clinton and an insult to Jen Arena. And afterwards, after he got caught, first he denied it, but then he admitted it. And he wrote a letter of apology to Bill Clinton.
He
never apologized to Hillary. Never apologized to Chelsea, and was specifically asked whether he was going to apologize to Jen, and he said, I see no reason to do so. So this was strictly a man-to-man thing. He'd wounded another man's honor through his women and therefore had to apologize to the man.
Yeah, a Republican journalist said something which I think is totally true. I think I may have said this on Bogging Heads before, but I'll say it again because it's worth repeating. He said, you know, John McCain believes in duty, honor, and country, and nothing else. And I think that really, you know, he is sort of like this, you know, and this is what 22-year-old boys are like, right? And you put a bunch of them together and you get a flyboy culture, especially because the pilots are the elite. You get a culture that's, you know, like has, I greatly admire the military virtues. But I also think that when you put a bunch of 22-year-old men together and sort of encourage very great machismo, you also get this. But, you know, most military men grow out of this by the time they're in their late 20s, right? They don't walk around saying stuff like that about people's kids. This is like, you know, this is something, this is the kind of stupid crap that you say when you're in college. And everyone, there's some variant of it in everyone's life. I don't think it's certainly not restricted to men. But you're supposed to grow out of it. And he doesn't seem like he's ever grown out of any of it. He treated his wife appallingly. He left her because she had gotten old and was in a wheelchair. And he thinks that he's supposed to be, he seems to think that he's supposed to be 22 for the rest of his life, and we're supposed to act like he's 22 for the rest of his life. I really don't approve of him, like, almost on any level. I don't approve of his political persona and his, you know, I probably have more policy agreement with him on a lot of issues than I do with Obama, but I have more agreement with Barack Obama's decision-making style than I have with McCain's. But more fundamentally, like, as a person, he's done just these unbelievably unattractive things, and what he does then is, I was reading A Drinking Life by Pete Hamill, which I'm sure you must have read.
No, I actually haven't, I should.
Well, it's interesting because Pete Hamill struck me in exactly the same way that a lot of that he thought that merely by sort of mentioning that he behaved like a complete word I'm not going to say on camera, that like somehow, okay, well, you know, he's acknowledged it, let's move on. And that's what McCain does over and over again. It's like, yeah, I did something really appalling, I've acknowledged it, now you can't talk about it because I've acknowledged it. And in some cases, I think that's, it's legitimate. Like, I think that in the case of, you know, George Bush having given up drinking, like, it wasn't appropriate to attack him for having been an alcoholic at the age of 30 when he was running at the age of, you know, 48. Certainly, if, you know, like, people have brought up fears that he's drinking again, and that's totally legitimate. But on the campaign stump, that's not appropriate to bring up. It was 18 years ago, and he's not, and he has spent 18 years not doing it. John McCain has not spent 18 years not acting like all of the terrible things. Like, he just keeps popping up with them. He called his wife a word that I won't say on camera. His wife.
And
to other people. You know, like, I'm sure that in fights, like, I've had boyfriends say things about, you know, to me that were that bad. But it's not something that you say about someone that you allegedly love to other people in public. Like, what the hell? So on every level, I think that he's just adolescent. So sorry, that was my McCain rant. And, you know, and he embodies a certain kind of conservatism that, again, like, I find the military virtues incredibly admirable, and I'm probably more than most libertarians. I admire them greatly, and I admire, I think that a society has to have people who are willing to do those things to be healthy. And so one of the reasons I'm opposed to the draft is that I very honestly believe that any society that cannot mobilize its men, and hopefully its women, to defend it in time of need doesn't deserve to survive. But I don't want them in my president, and I certainly don't want a particular kind of, like, now we've got a bunch of 22-year-old boys around with no adult supervision, and, you know, the place is run for the benefit of them, like, fine in a frat house, not so fine in the White House. And it's not clear to me that he's ever sort of gotten over that stage of his life.
Yeah, and I think that's the most damaging thing about the Palin pick is, you know, he wanted Lieberman. He got forced off that by Rove and the preachers. They basically said, look, if you pick Lieberman, there will be a floor fight. And so he couldn't have Lieberman, he couldn't have Ridge, because Ridge is also pro-choice. And I think Palin was in many ways just his giving the finger to all those people. Okay, you guys want Romney, you can't have Romney. You won't let me have Lieberman, whom I want. All right, Sarah Palin. How do you like that?
I will say that actually, like, having trashed him personally, I think that he actually has a number of personal virtues that, like, you know, one of the reasons that he wants Lieberman is that he's ferociously personally loyal.
Yes.
And, you know, I remember a conservative journalist who certainly agrees with me about drug companies saying to me, like, you know, it's true, he bashes, like, once he's got in sort of in his head that an industry is bad, he then goes over the top and freaks out and enacts all these ridiculous regulations, much like the campaign finance regulations that he himself then violated. that said, like, what he said is, look, you know, they dropped the ball because you can't, he's persuadable. If you go in and make the case and you make it well, he will be on your side. So it's not, he's not an ideologue. He is very loyal and he exemplifies a lot of virtues that I think are really valuable in terms of, like, sort of just personal values. But I kind of feel like he's like a kid who's like going to be a really good kid when he grows up.
Right. Right. So let's talk about areas in which risk-taking is not the same as recklessness.
Yes, let's talk about sex ed, because this has obviously come up with Bristol Palin, and I triggered like a huge firestorm by making what I had taken to be a fairly actually uncontroversial claim among researchers that there's just not much evidence that you can reduce teen pregnancy with any sort of sex ed. That no matter what you do, kids get pregnant. You know, it varies widely, but it varies widely on things like income and demographics, and sort of where you live and cultural and religious issues. What it doesn't vary by is whether you were taught about the pill and condoms or not.
Mm-hmm.
And this just freaked everyone out. Which surprised me, because these are, you know, the liberal commenters were freaking out at me and saying, this can't possibly be true. Look at the Netherlands, where teen pregnancy is low. Although, then someone else came back, and I haven't had time to check this claim. It was like, no, it's not their teen pregnancies that are low, it's their births that are low. They have a lot of abortions. But I don't think that's true, in fact.
I don't think that's right. I mean, my understanding is that continental Europe has much higher rates of sexual activity among teenagers and much lower rates of pregnancy.
No, I don't think it's higher rates of sexual activity. I think that's shockingly constant, is my understanding. I would have to go back and look at that.
Right.
Because what I've been specifically researching for the past few days is the effect of education in the Anglosphere.
Right.
But sorry about that, more technical problems.
Yes,
this time
right.
on Mark's end. I'm not always at fault.
Yes, right, exactly.
But so the question I wanted to ask you, Mark, is why doesn't telling kids how to, you know, what behaviors are risky and what the risks are and how to avoid them, why doesn't this work?
Because they're immortal. Because
and yet they have a time horizon of like a week.
They have a time horizon about a week. They have, I think this is true, I'm not sure I know the data. They have far more optimistic bias even than adults do, and of course adults have a lot of optimistic bias. My favorite number here is that if you ask people to estimate the probability that a driver will be involved in an auto accident over the course of a year,
mm-hmm.
and then ask them to estimate the probability that they will be involved in an auto accident over the course of the year, 90% of drivers are better than average.
See, I'm lucky. I know I'm not, because
right.
I grew up in Manhattan and I didn't start driving until I was 23.
Right. So,
but yeah, almost everyone I know thinks it's shocking, because the same people that I naming no names that I know, like others of their friends are like, God, I won't get in a car with them.
Right. Exactly.
And then they complain about the bad drivers.
Right. So we all live in Lake Wobegon, but I think teenagers live more in Lake Wobegon than the rest of us. By the way, it turns out that there is a psychological term for people who have accurate self perceptions.
Mentally depressed.
Correct. So it's not surprising that the kids take risks. I'm sure the broader culture doesn't help. You know, I'm sure it's true that lots of American boys and probably most American girls would be embarrassed to go into a drugstore and buy a condom. It's not that they're not there, but the fact that TV stations still won't run ads for them. Really,
I know 30-year-old men who are still embarrassed to go into the drugstore and buy condoms.
All right, exactly. Exactly. Look, you know, I mean, how many condom jokes do you know? I know about six.
I don't think I know any, actually.
I see. Well, all right. Well, I won't tell the whole thing, but the punchline is, I hope I didn't screw up your whole weekend. So I think all that's a problem. But the broader problem is, you know, if you think about the dose of sex education or drug education that goes on in a school, we're talking about a few hours out of a lifetime. if it were possible to substantially change opinion and behavior, with that small a dose of persuasion, then totalitarianism would be a workable form of government.
So thank God that we can't control our teenagers' minds.
Exactly. I mean, look, if parents could do what they really want to do with their kids, the human race would never make any progress. Parents don't want kids to think differently than the parents do.
Right.
So in this particular case, you know, I'm entirely on the parents' side, but I don't find it acutely distressing that you can't strongly alter people's behavior just by talking at them, particularly
right.
in an area so emotion charged.
Well, I also think that people are discounting the fact that there are real costs to this stuff. Like, you know, the main three forms. I mean, part of it is that a lot of, you know, I remember getting like lengthy, and I'm one of these weird people who actually remembers what they learned in sex ed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shocking to me that like other people in my high school class didn't remember. We had sex ed. Our sex ed started in sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
It was contraception focused. We had lectures on, I don't know why we had so much of it. We had it every year from sixth grade through 10th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it must have gotten more complicated at some point, but, you know, it was like, you know, you learned all about the reproductive system and all the forms of birth control. At one point, I remember my seventh grade teacher marching in and saying, okay, my science teacher and saying, we're starting the unit on sex ed on Monday, so on Sunday night, I want you to, like, get naked, stand in front of the mirror, and giggle all you want, because like, I'm not having it on Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had to go ask our parents about what kind of birth control they used. It was all very legal in Manhattan. My mother's very, like, scientific and so forth about these sorts of things.
Still.
I knew all the, you know, we didn't have, like, euphemisms.
Right.
We were, like, full-on biological Latin names. Nonetheless, and I'm, like, I retained all of it because I was, like, one of those sponge kids. I remember talking to kids in my high school just being shocked at how little they retained of this fairly crucial information about things like, you know, what's the effectiveness of the pill, what happens when you go off of it, and all that. And we didn't have Google. I mean, this is part of, remember, I was in the antediluvian generation that couldn't Google these important facts, so we just had to remember them.
Yeah.
And no one in my high school class by senior year seemed to remember any of it.
Yeah, well, they probably don't know much about history either.
Yeah, I mean, people don't retain that much of what they learn in school. I certainly, I can still remember the quadratic equation, but only because my crazy Jamaican algebra teacher, who was wonderful and brilliant, single-handedly turned me into a math whiz, used to, like, actually, she was like, if I call you up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're going to be able to tell me what the quadratic equation is.
Right.
And she would, and then she would make you bark it out. It was kind of like being, but in general, most people just don't retain that much. But also, this stuff actually really does have costs, right? Like, condoms reduce your pleasure, and the Depo-Provera shot makes you gain quite a lot of weight, 5 to 10 pounds.
Wow.
Sometimes more than 10 pounds for, you know, more than 70% of the girls who take it. And the pill is, you know, it's, you have to remember to take it at the same time every day, and if you don't, it's, you know, not as effective, and your mom can find it. There are actually real costs to these things, and I expect that some of the difference, between it, because, you know, the consistent result in the Anglosphere is that if you do, you can get sort of vaguely positive results from one study or another, but if you look at groups of studies, those, you get some positive and some negative, and what it ends up with is that there doesn't seem to be much overall effect, and it really doesn't matter what you teach kids, as long as they know sort of like what sex is and how babies get made,
right,
as most kids do. There's not that much of a value add from teaching them comprehensive contraception information or comprehensive abstinence information. It just doesn't change their behavior very much.
The part of the bottom line on that, just to tie it back to the campaign for a minute, is that we would expect that some kids are going to get pregnant and that some of them are going to need help from other people, you know, if their parents aren't prosperous. And so I think Sarah Palin's kid got pregnant and she's in favor of abstinence-only sex education is really pretty disgusting. But
although it's actually not clear that she is either. They seem to be taking that from a speech that she gave in front of Feminists for Life, where someone said, you know, do you think that we should have, like, really explicit sex education or abstinence-only? And she said, well, not explicit.
Right. But whatever. I mean, as you say, the data is not, you know, all that overwhelming. The fact that in this year's budget she cut out the money for shelters for pregnant teenagers doesn't seem to me
that
reflect pretty badly.
And I, you know, like, I think that would be a, like, a perfectly legitimate plant question at a town hall or whatever. And, you know, I certainly would hope that the Obama campaign would do that, because that right. is sort of a... and not, again, like, you know, I'm sure that I'm now going to get, like, my conservative commenters are going to flood in and be like, well, her, you know, their family should take care of them. But, you know, sometimes their families don't. And you got a kid with a kid, right. and, you know, who did something dumb, like many teenagers do, including probably yours. Not that you necessarily know right. about it. Part of it is, like, I have all these parents in there, like, sort of saying, well, but my kids, I raise them right, and they don't do dumb things. It's like, you know, it's very probable that you just don't know exactly. what dumb things they're doing.
Exactly.
Right? But, you know, what they are is good at hiding it from you.
Well, Megan, but, once again, we managed to get to the end of our hour, and you haven't told me about why it's good to have strong risk-bearing institutions in a society. So
okay, well, we will do this. We will do 5 minutes on risk-bearing
okay.
institutions.
And next time I'm going to interview
huge.
You. So there.
Okay. And right. I'll rant less. But you know, I think that one of the issues that I'm working that I sort of perennially work on is things like bankruptcy. And the grand narrative of the bankruptcy bill was, on the one hand, the bank lobbying group called me up and was like, don't you understand, these people are all deadbeats. And then the Consumer Federation of America called me up and was like, don't you understand, these people are all desperately needy people who've been hoodwinked by the credit card corporations. And neither of these narratives is really particularly compelling. Most people who have credit card debt got into credit card debt not spending it on things that they desperately actually like had to have. And most people who declare bankruptcy could have lived, you know, they could have lived under what they did live on. And most people who declare bankruptcy do it either because they were alcoholic or addicted to drugs or because they got a divorce, not because they had medical bills. You know, you have to include things like gambling addiction in the definition of a medical bankruptcy to get to medical bills is a really significant portion. And even when medical bills are a significant portion, it's not the bills, it's the income loss. It's not because the health system has failed them, it's because they don't have a
right.
job anymore. So, you know, so that was, to me, that narrative was kind of irrelevant. It was like, you know, I was looking around and saying, well, why, because the laws under which debts get discharged, they don't have particular moral content as long as everyone knows what the laws are, right? If the bank is willing to lend you money under a specific set of
right.
laws, they know what risk
right.
they're taking. If you're willing to borrow the money, you know what risk.
So, in effect, the bankruptcy bill was renegotiating a bunch of old contracts in favor of the banks.
Right, and I actually think that, you know, one of the things is that, honestly, like, there should have been... it's complicated because these things can go back for years or whatever. You can't say that on a 30-year mortgage you're going to give... You can't... If someone has old
right.
debt and new debt,
right.
you can't split it. But I would have said there should have been a grace period. There should have been 5 years where, like, you know, this will take
right.
effect in 5 years. And until that 5-year period is done, things will be settled out in the field. Yeah, it was absolutely a lobbying effort, a very successful lobbying effort by the banks to renegotiate contracts in their favor, arbitrarily
right.
you know, by fiat. In much the same way that, like, you know, to be fair and stick at the left now, this is basically what Democrats are proposing to do to mortgage lenders. It's like arbitrarily rewrite contracts in favor of
right.
the borrowers. Neither of which I think is appropriate. But the thing to me was to look at, do we have a credit shortage? Because the problem with having bankruptcy that's too easy is that it
right.
makes it harder to borrow money. Because people are less willing to lend. This was not an issue. We didn't have a credit shortage. There was no problem with interest rates being too high. There was no problem with people not being able to get loans.
Well, but
so if
but
any broke
credit card interest rates are incredibly high, and I assume at least part of that was, you know, collection risk.
It is. I mean, like, I should say that. But it wasn't so high that people, you know, in general, because... Credit card, you know, in general, the risks, it is collection risk. It's actually shocking when nonprofits try to get into these businesses, like payday loans and so forth, how high the interest rates
right.
they have to charge are. You know, they still end up charging things like 10 to 20%
right.
of paycheck. On, you know, like a two, whatever, the APR for a nonprofit might be 350% instead
right.
of 500%, but it's still
right.
really high because the collection risk on these things is enormous. But... That said, you know, there wasn't a credit
mm-hmm.
shortage in the market. There weren't borrowers who were being shut out by the high interest rates, and there weren't people who were good credit risk, they got, you know, they were
right.
getting better at it. So people who were good credit risks weren't paying those high interest rates. The if you were a low collection risk, you were paying a low interest rate. If you were a high collection risk, as you should be.
So is there any evidence that the interest rates came down after the bankruptcy bill? I mean, you'd expect that they would, right?
It's not clear because there are so many... well, actually, what's interesting is yes and no. Or at least I'm aware of an as-yet unpublished paper from a respected economist who I won't name that said that, you know, behavior was exactly what neoclassical economics would have predicted, which is that the lenders mm-hmm. became much more willing to lend at better, more attractive rates. And the borrowers said, no, I don't want any more money because it was harder to get out mm-hmm. from under the unsecured debt. There's also apparently been some, you know, I'm working on a story on this now, there's been some fairly irrational behavior in the bankruptcy market as well. Bankruptcies have plummeted mm-hmm. and they haven't come back up, even though it's not that much harder to go bankrupt. So it's not clear right. exactly what's happening on the borrower side, but basically on the borrower side, they didn't want to borrow the money after they thought mm-hmm. it was going to be hard to shed it, which is totally rational, pretty much what you in neoclassical right. economics would predict. So yeah, it became easier to borrow money after the bankruptcy bill, but it wasn't hard to borrow money before. And there was no, you know, you don't, the only way that you're, you know, sort of in aggregate going to save people money, right, is by not letting them borrow the money. What happens when you make it hard, you know, the way we were going to lower the interest rates is by restricting the credit to the people who qualified yeah, exactly. for high interest rates. Or making their interest rates even higher, right. right? Because, so there was no real benefit to this bill to anyone except the credit card companies, which got a big windfall that they shouldn't have gotten, courtesy of many Democratic and Republican legislators, including our very own Joe Biden, who you know was out there fighting for the folks of Delaware. For viewers who don't know, Delaware is the right. credit card capital of the United States.
What was the impact on entrepreneurship, right? Because and we talked about this.
Right. We don't have data on it yet. What we know, though, and people are doing work on that now, and it's just starting to come out because mm-hmm. it's so new. You know, for economic analysis, you have to start the study, gather the data. You know, the thing only took effect 2 years ago, really. And you got to gather the data, and then you got to crunch the data. We're not going to get good data on that. We don't even know who the subprime borrowers are. We're just at the point 3 years into this problem where people are going to allegedly in September, Brookings is looking to release a study on who these people are and how they sort of how they're faring in the market. No one knows. So, you know, my take on it was given that we don't have a problem in the credit markets, let's look at what the other effects are. What the other effects are is we have really good data on the effects of making bankruptcy easier or harder to get, because even though bankruptcy in the United States is federal, what's exempt from bankruptcy right. is different in each state. So, for example, it's called, you know, the right. big one is the homestead exemption. This is your home.
So in Florida, you can put $20 million in your home.
Your home is exempt from bankruptcy. Right. In Florida mm-hmm. and in Texas are the two states with unlimited homestead exemptions. This is what OJ did, and there's now actually the bankruptcy bill did fix that. This is the OJ exemption. You can no longer do that to get. You can no longer do it if the purpose is to evade payment, to evade suit in a, mm-hmm. in a civil trial. You can still do it if it's ordinary sort of unsecured debt creditors that you're trying to shield the money from. So anyway, you know, what we do know is that states with high homestead exemptions, in other words, states where you can keep a very expensive home, because there's a limit. And in Delaware, it's $3,000, or it was last time I looked, which is, you know, I mean, it's obviously left over from sort of 50 years ago, and no one updated it, and the credit card companies like it that way, so it stays that way. And then in other states like Texas and Florida, it's totally unlimited. Well, in states that have a higher homestead exemption, in other words, states in which you can shield more access, for most people, their home is not only their major asset, it's where they live. It's to think about losing your home because you had to declare bankruptcy is a major thing. So in states where you can shield more home from creditors, entrepreneurship is
terrific.
Higher. And that's
what a great
really
result.
Unambiguous. It's also true across countries. Right. So why would we want to do something that's not helping the credit markets, right? We know that there's not a supply problem in the credit markets. why would we want to make bankruptcy harder to fix a problem that doesn't exist, meanwhile creating a problem that we really do know exists? And this was, for me, the real... But I think that there's a bigger story here, which is that America, bankruptcy and institutions like it, are America's great strength. We are a risk-loving society relative to almost anywhere else in the world. People risk failure routinely mm-hmm. here in a way that they don't in Europe. In Europe, if you're a business executive is attached to a firm that goes down, you will never work again. You're done. You get a nice safety net, you know, the state will take care of you, but you will not have a responsible job again. This is somewhat, it's changing somewhat in Britain, and it's always been slightly different mm-hmm. in Britain, but certainly in continental Europe. And in continental Europe, bankruptcy is, like, to us, our bankruptcy law, after the draconian reform that I was assured was going to thrust millions of people into poverty, is still so far and away the most generous bankruptcy code in the country that when I tried to describe the new law, the draconian new law, to my colleagues at The Economist, which is where I was working at the time, they didn't believe what they thought
Britain,
I was making.
In Britain,
that you could just walk away from it. Just be like, no, I can't pay
Britain,
the money.
If you go bankrupt,
sorry.
You lose your license to practice law or medicine.
You also have to pay the money back. There is no other country in the world where an individual can just say, I can't pay the money. In every other country in the world, if there is even bankruptcy at all, mm. which there is not in many countries. In many countries, your debts just follow you, and right. in some cases, they can be inherited. So they follow your children, which is delightful. But there is no other country in the world where they do not make you go on a payment plan. The budgets are draconian compared to what are... You know, we have Chapter 13, which is the same thing, which you pay part of the money back.
Right.
But we're really rather generous with what the judges are rather generous with what they consider to be sort of needs compared to what European judges are. And in places like Scandinavia, if they just decided you wasted the money, they'll deny you a discharge anyway. Which is ridiculous because bankruptcy is recognizing a fact, right? It's recognizing the fact that there's no reasonable possibility that this person is ever going to repay this money. And it's a terrible drag on the economy. It's when, you know, economists have this thing called sunk costs, right? You don't want to throw good money after bad. You don't, for example, I invested $20,000 in this stupid project. My company invested $30,000 in this stupid project. Well, now it needs $50,000 to save it. Well, you know, the mentality is often like, well, we have to because otherwise we're going to lose $30,000. And yes, double down, right? The human instinct is often to double down when you've made a bad bet. But in fact, you know, you have to think of that money is gone. You can't get it back. What you should be looking at is prospectively, what are the best investments to make? And the American system allows people to do that. And it also doesn't, on the other end, it doesn't do what a lot of European welfare systems do, which is like, oh, you really want to be a steelworker? Okay, well, we're going to pay you until you find another steelworking job. So you just stay home, and when a steelworking job comes, you'll take that. You have to recognize, you have to cut your losses. In both
the Swedes do that, right? I mean,
you know, you let people. The Danes are the people you're thinking about. Other people, the Danish model is now seen as sort of the gold standard for a large European welfare state. That basically says to people, like, look, we'll give you money to retrain, but we're not going to pay you to sit on the dole for 10 years, waiting to do the same thing that you did before. If you can't get a new job in your existing job description, you've got to learn to do something else, which has its own issues. I mean, like, you know, 55-year-olds aren't really that enthusiastic about, like, learning to be gardeners or whatever. But in general, this is a much better approach than, say, the German approach, which was just, wait, something will come along. And the Germans are now, and other people are now in Europe, certainly in Germany and France, are now trying to reform their unemployment systems to be more like the Danish system. But America has a number of great institutions for letting people fail. Just our business culture is great. Our political culture is great for letting people screw up and say, okay, well, I screwed up. And if you think about it, we all know this, right? We learn more from our failures than from our successes.
Right.
You fail in one way. You fail in some, like, really spectacular way. Nature's way, failure, like pain, misery, is nature's way of telling you, don't do that. And it's really effective. And so when people fail, they have a lot of useful information. They've learned, there's a famous anecdote about Thomas Edison, which may or may not be correct, but where he was sort of, when he was trying to invent the incandescent light bulb, and he sort of, 2 weeks from the deadline for this contest, there was a prize offered by a newspaper, some reporter and said, well, how does it feel to have failed? And he said, what do you mean failed?
Right.
I've learned 10,000 things that don't
right,
work.
Exactly.
But that's actually true. Knowing that those 10,000 things don't make good light bulb filaments is really useful information. And when you have a society that doesn't value failure, that says once you've failed, you're no good to us, and you know, go sit by the fire and be ashamed, once you have that society, you're losing huge amounts of information about what doesn't work. And you know, I don't want to oversell this. Failure needs to hurt, because
right.
otherwise people will take too much risk. But the American way is uniquely good at making it hurt really bad for a short period of time,
right.
and then
right.
letting you move on, and making you move on. That we are the best in the world at doing that. And that is I think that more than any of the, you know, tax rates or whatever, that is the strength of the American economy. That is why we continue. We have a crappy education system. Our corporate taxes, our tax system is unbelievably screwed up. Our regulation isn't so hot either. But we've got this one thing, which is that we let people try stuff, have it not work, and then go try something else and keep going until
right.
they figure it out. And, you know, I look at the people, because I graduated from business school in 2001, and a lot of people in the class before me, my class, and the class after, were just devastated by this because, you know, all the jobs that people had planned for didn't materialize. The company I was supposed to work for just, like, fired my whole associate class without any of us ever having worked a day for them after stringing us along for quite a
while. Oh, come on now. Don't let them be anonymous. That's sort of behavior ought to be punished.
There's a firm called Diamond Cluster. I mean, they're really they fired us all because I think they still exist.
Do I have to guess?
Not,
do I have to guess
firm.
What everybody
was,
in your
at the time
class
it was
called
like the
Diamond
hot
Cluster
technology firm
when this was done? I probably don't.
But you know, I look at people who had this happen to them, and you know, it wasn't always that they made bad decisions or smart decisions, right? Like people who went one of my friends was pointing out that he knew a guy who had gone into oil, which looked like who had gone into technology,
right.
which looked like a smart bet in 1997, and then he got fired for no fault of his own because his firm just ran out of money. And other people who say became like an oil and gas analyst at a time when that looked like when that was really sort of like a second tier
right.
job that you took if
right.
you couldn't get into one of the really good investment banking divisions, and then took off.
Right.
They weren't prescient. They got overtaken by events. But after that happens, so failure is not always about what you do. It isn't, you know, I didn't get fired because I chose wrong. Or in some sense I did, but it wasn't predictable. This firm was going to be the one out of four
right.
consulting firms who offered me jobs and was going to be in the business. What it is that after it happens, you learn what you can from it. And then, you know, you keep trying stuff until it works. And the people that I saw who succeeded were the people who just kept trying something. Whatever it was, you know, they often sort of flailing, it took them a while and whatever, but they just, and the people I know who feel stuck and trapped are the people who just stopped trying. They just sort of gave up, got a job somewhere, and
right.
decided that, you know, their life was over. And that's a very European mentality, and I think that, you know, there's comparisons about sort of happiness in various cultures, and that idea of like, well, you know, you're supposed to
mm-hmm.
sort of be content with what you're given. And that having failed is somehow a disgrace and disqualifies you. The American idea is like, oh, well, you know, that just
right.
happened. It's over. Next. And that really works well for business culture. It works well for economic culture. It works
right.
well for scientific culture. And certainly many of our scientists are not American, but they come here to be in a culture that encourages that and that, you know, everything about like our research institutions and so forth. It's not that we're the only people doing good research, but we do more good research. We fight out of our weight class by GDP, by population,
by
any measure you want. We fight out of our
my misspent youth.
I
worked for Edwin Land at Polaroid, and he used to say, "No person and no institution that cannot fail cheerfully will ever achieve anything great."
So that's my 20-minute spiel on failure, the secret
right.
hidden strength of the American economy, and why we should actively encourage smart risk-taking. I'm not saying we should, but risk-loving societies in the long run, as long as they're good at cleaning up the mess. And we've gotten very good at cleaning up the mess as part of it. And Europe is not good at cleaning up its mess. It is good at making sure that people don't suffer, and that is nothing to be sneezed at. But it is not good at cleaning up the mess and moving on, and that makes them more risk-averse, because they, as a society, they have to be. If you can't clean up the mess once you've failed, you better be risk-averse. My basic thing is that I think taking risks, figuring out what's failed, cutting your losses and moving on is absolutely the recipe for a dynamic, healthy, not just economy. I mean, I'm an American chauvinist, but I think also...
part of the lesson here is that if you want really good high-wire performers, you need very strong nets.
Possibly. Or certainly a certain kind of net.
Right.
Because the German net didn't do it any good.
Right.
The German net actively worked against it. So it isn't so much the existence of a safety net. It's not necessarily the existence of a social... I mean, obviously, I would say this, I'm a libertarian, but it's not necessarily the existence of this gigantic welfare state. But what it is the net has to be, America has a different kind of net, but it has a very strong net. Things like bankruptcy are a very strong net, and I'm sad to see us trying to cut them in, because we've got this sort of Puritan attitude about debt, that it's bad and wrong and people should be punished for having taken
it. All right. Well, on that, absolutely. Always
anyway,
a pleasure, Megan.
We should probably end it on that happy note.
Again soon.
Great to talk to you again, Mark, and I hope to talk to you again soon. Take care.